Coming up on this week's book show, bestselling author Russell Shorto never thought to write about his own past. He grew up knowing his grandfather and namesake was a small-town mob boss, but maintained an unspoken family vow of silence. Then an elderly relative prodded, "You're a writer. What are you going to do about the story?" The result is Small Time, a story of my family and the mob. Russell Shorto on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Bestselling author Russell Shorto, praised for his incisive works of narrative history, never thought to write about his own past. He grew up knowing his grandfather and namesake was a small-town mob boss, but maintained an unspoken family vow of silence. Then an elderly relative prodded, "You're a writer. What are you going to do about the story?" Shorto's new book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. He is the best-selling author of The Island at the Center of the World, Amsterdam, and Revolution Song, and a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. It is a great pleasure to welcome Russell Shorto to this week's book show. Russell, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
So what brought you to really a personal story, a story that is about your family and something that you wanted to investigate further?
Well, I write narrative history. That's kind of what I do for a living. And it's always been books that are set in the past. It's always nonfiction history. I wrote The Island at the Center of the World about the Dutch founding of what became New York. And I wrote a book about the American Revolution. And it never occurred to me to write about my grandfather, who was a small town mob guy. And I think because I grew up with this, you know, everybody who we grew up in the same town, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, in the family, we kind of knew you don't talk about that. So I was kind of an obedient son and I didn't go there. And even in my own mind, I didn't go there. And then one day, a relative who had, I found out later, who had worked for my grandfather as a numbers runner and things, he left town, moved to Las Vegas, had his whole career there as a jazz musician. And then he came home, he retired and came home, and he said to me, "Hey, you're a writer, what are you gonna do about this story?" And he kind of popped he broke down that wall. And so I suddenly thought, yeah, this is American history. It's really an unknown history in many respects. Everybody knows the mob in Chicago or Philly or New York, but the small town mob that was, you know, in Albany, of course, people do know somewhat about the doings in Albany, but most other places, you know, in Amarillo, Texas, or Butte, Montana, or Johnstown, Pennsylvania, it was a very organized enterprise. So it's that kind of history. But for me, it's this personal story in the center.
So when your mother's cousin comes to town and says this to you, "Are you going to write this story?" And then you decide that you're going to write the story. Did you really know fully what the story was?
No. I mean, I had an idea in my head. And I was wary for one reason, even after he kind of broke down this mental wall, I was wary because I write nonfiction, and I didn't want to just write something that's, you know, a few people's memories. So I had to base it on really hard grounding. But finally, I was interested enough that I said to him, "Look, I'll come home for a week and I'll see, you know, what there is." And he said, "Meet me at my hangout," which was Panera Bread, "and we'll discuss." So we sat down and I turned on my recorder and I thought, okay, he's going to tell me some stories or point me in some direction or other. And soon some little old guy comes up, and then another one, and then another one. And suddenly there were like eight people, you know, kind of leaning on their canes and everything. He'd put out the word. And we were there for 4 hours, and I turned off the recorder and said, okay, there's something here. There is, you know, what I realized was the people, my grandfather and his generation are gone. But these were the young guys who admired them and followed their every move and knew quite a bit. But still, for me, that was just, it was a good basis, but I needed to ground it. You know, people recollecting, just swapping stories about 60 years ago or something. Mm. I needed something more solid. So then slowly with police records and files from the courthouse and FBI records, I was able to then kind of document and give this a grounding that to me felt solid.
What's so fascinating is that you learn that your grandfather and your great uncle basically run the town, right? I mean, they're the heartbeat.
Yeah. Yeah, they paid off the politicians, and they the center of their it was all about gambling in their heyday. And the center of their operation was a numbers game. And this is, you know, there's nothing unique about Johnstown. This was going on everywhere. They had a numbers game, which they called the GI Bank. And I think they chose GI because they started it right during or after World War II. And it felt like, it felt patriotic, like you were supporting the returning troops or something. And half the town played it. And they employed, just in that, they employed about 100 people. Numbers runners and accountants, and they had a variety of other forms of gambling, regular card and dice games. There was something called tip seals, which were very big then, which were kind of like a lottery where you scratch off your ticket and see if you won or not. The base of their operation was they had two pool halls. One was two doors from City Hall. It was called City Cigar. There was a little cigar stand in front. And, you know, the mayor would come in and they would presumably, you know, they would make arrangements with him. And then they had, and that was kind of for the elite to hang out, the lawyers and things. Right. And then a couple blocks away was another pool hall which was right by the gate where the steel mill employees got out, the workers got out. And that was for the regular guys.
Oh, and by the way, you're named after him.
Right. Maybe that was an impetus to look into it, or maybe it kind of prevented me from looking into it. But yeah, I mean, he was originally, I mean, this is Sicilian. His parents came from Sicily, and he was originally Rosario Shorto, and it got Americanized to Russell Shorto. There's a Sicilian naming tradition where the firstborn son names his son after his father. So I then was named after him, that is to say my grandfather. So yeah, that was part of, I guess, the mystery. In my family, my grandfather everybody told me he was a very quiet guy. I mean, some people thought he was almost pathologically shy. And so he's this kind of figure of mystery, which makes it a challenge if you're trying to write a book about the guy, and everybody says, well, he was very quiet. It's like, well, can you tell me more? So that was a challenge, which I think I managed to crack it. Of course, you never, when you're writing about the past, you never have enough. But I can't, one strategy I came upon was to do history, to treat him like a historical figure. And I went to Sicily, went to the hometown of his parents, and talked to people there, spent time in the archives there. And then it becomes a different kind of story. Then it becomes really a classic American immigrant story. You're watching these people come from the old country. They're terribly poor. They come to America initially to work in coal mines. And then I see him growing up in poverty and real discrimination, which really kind of resonates with where we are today, with the way people are perceiving immigrants. So they were very much discriminated against. And that's where the mob comes out of. It comes out of discrimination. So here are this young generation growing up. They're from their parents are from southern Italy, and they are constricted in what they're allowed to do in American society, and yet they're told to admire, you know, American can-do capitalism, and then prohibition comes along, and so here's this wonderful opportunity, and that's what they did. They had a still in their house, and he would go out and sell Coke bottles filled with moonshine, and that's really how the mob developed around the country.
How much of this did you know going in the sense that your grandfather was with the mob? Did you know that?
Yeah, you know, I'll bet everybody has in their family some story or some things that happened in the family in the past and nobody talks about. And yet, as a kid, you just absorb it. You just know it somehow. It was at that level. I knew that by the time I was aware, He was also along with a lot of other things, he became progressively more and more of a drunk, and he got so bad that he was kind of booted out of the operation. But according to one story, he excused himself, said, "I'm no good to you anymore." So I encountered him a few times early on in my life when I was really young, and then he was just this kind of, you know, what I really remember is this time I was with my mother downtown, and we see this old guy in a baggy gray suit and kind of a growth of beard on him. And I knew who he was right away. And he talked to my mother for a second. And then what I remember is he took this heavy, I guess, expensive watch off of his wrist and put it on mine, like here. And even that gesture, you know, it felt like this isn't right. You don't give a little kid something like this, you know? So that's how I knew him. And that's how the sense in which I knew that he was, this kind of figure.
Russell Shorto is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob, and it is published by Norton. How much did your mother and father talk about it, even later on?
It would come up. When people, like when the family were gathered, something would trigger a memory, and somebody would kind of wink and say a sentence or two about back then. Like my dad would say he had this memory from childhood, like opening his parents' bedroom door, and his dad is there, and he's got stacks of bills all across the bed. And my dad realized later, that when he was older, that he was making up the banks for the different bookies, you know. So he would toss out little things like that. So you get little snapshots of things.
I mentioned that I wanted to talk to you more about the grounding. Given your work, you've been known to work with 400-year-old documents. So what was it like to deal, even to take it as history and to try to veer away from the personal? How different was it in the fact that you were dealing with someone that were people that were involved were still alive?
It's a whole different thing, and it was really fun to do history that's within living memory, and you're talking to people who were, you know, giving you their memories, and then you can compare that against a newspaper account or police records or whatever. So it was fun to have people. In other words, it's kind of like you have all these partners who are working on it with you. And my main partner was my dad, who was my grandfather's oldest son, and he of course knew his father, but he always said that he never knew him because his father put up this guard. So he undertook this with me as, I guess, a project he was helping me, but he was also curious as we went along about, you know, what can we find out about this guy? And my grandfather did a lot of things that in his personal life that really harmed the family, especially his wife, my grandmother, and his kids, and maybe my father was most affected by him. So it became, to your point, that definitely takes it out of, I'm not just writing history about something that happened 400 years ago. I'm writing something, I'm working on this with my father, and we're trying to understand where he came from and all these sources of pain for him when he was growing up.
Because your father and his father spent a long time not speaking to one another. So there was stress in that relationship. And when he decided to help you, this is at the end of your father's life too. So that must have been incredibly rewarding, not only to be working with your dad, but to also be working on a family history.
Yeah, in addition to it being fun, to engage with people who are living and helping you on this, it was also difficult at times and painful. But it's also very rewarding, and I've become kind of a promoter of the idea of doing family history. And in fact, I taught a course at City University of New York on doing family history, and then I turned that into an online course, tellyourfamilystory.com. So if anybody's interested in doing that, and I kind of guide you through the steps of it, because it's, you know, first of all, it's not for the faint of heart, because you're going to learn things that you may not want to know. But it's very rewarding, because so much of what we understand about our families it was packaged for us when we were children. And maybe that's enough for you. Maybe that sustains you for your whole life. But if you decide to explore it, the upside is you become, in a way, that you become a mature person, an adult. You know, you have this more complex understanding of your parents or your grandparents and the world that you came from.
One of the things about the book that I think is important is obviously you're writing about your grandfather and you're writing about the family and the mob. But let us key into the mob part, because this is really a look at the small town mob in America. And as you point out, it was not just in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. It was everywhere.
Yeah. And to me, that was, you know, my way in was, okay, I'm going to be writing a history of the small town mob. And then it progressively became more personal for me as an exploration. I talked before about how people of that generation, they were discriminated, and at the same time, they admired American capitalism. And so I was struck by the extent to which, as the mob spread out, they really copied the features of capitalism. They opened branch offices, and that's how the Johnstown branch got started. There was a guy who grew up in the Philadelphia mob who was given Johnstown, and he came and he happened to meet and fall in love with a woman who was my grandfather's sister. And my grandfather had been this young hustler and gambler and who would run card games out of the trunk of his car. So he knew the town from that level, and he hooks up with this guy who's dating his sister, and together they started this franchise. And using that, you know, looking at it through that kind of template, I mean, even, you know, they very much admired the big, powerful capitalists, people like Astor and Carnegie and Frick and Rockefeller. And they tried to follow them, you know, not just in opening branch offices, but in having providing a financial service. You know, there's a reason they called a numbers game a bank, because they looked at it as a kind of bank, and customers did too. The players did, you know, the numbers game started in Harlem, where blacks they distrusted banks, and banks wouldn't, I mean, you couldn't get if you were black, you couldn't get a mortgage from a bank or anything like that. So they played the numbers game as a form of investment. That's how they looked at it. So you were giving a nickel a day, playing the same number every day. And 10 years from now, you figured your number would hit. And that was the same as your CD maturing or something like that. So they had a bank, and they would make loans to people, and it was, of course, nothing was written down. They just knew, okay, I gave that guy money to put his kid in college or whatever. And you know, so there's that kind of aspect to all this, and how they, and then they, you know, they, so I'm in Western Pennsylvania in Johnstown. That's what we're talking about. But all the towns around there there was a similar operation in Altoona and McKeesport, of course, in Pittsburgh and in Braddock. So, you know, and they, to some extent, communicated. Often it was more aggressive. There was a lot of territorial disputes going on, but it was a network.
there were discrepancies along the way. Simple things like your grandfather may or may not have always carried a gun.
His kids have no memory at all of him ever doing that. However, two people that I talked to who knew him at different parts of his life, early and later, said he never left the house without a gun. You know, I think that may be a case where, of course, he's not going to show his kids that he's got one. Yeah.
Are those rabbit holes that you could go down of, oh, okay, I got to figure out whether he did or he didn't? And is that a challenge? And knowing when to say, okay, what I have is what I have, and I'll just stick with that. And also, there is a violent aspect to this. I mean, often some of this can have a nostalgic tinge to it, but it is and can often be violent crime.
Yeah, there was. I mean, there is, after all, a murder, an unsolved murder of a bookie at the center of the story. You know, that's one difference, I think, between the small town mob and the what happened in the big cities at the same time. That I think partly because it was a small town, they were able to operate largely in the open in their heyday. Everybody knew what was going on. Everybody availed themselves of their services. They all played the numbers and things. So as long as things didn't get out of hand, you were okay. So I think there was a kind of, because it was a small town, it was self-regulating, you know? So that's why we have an agreement. We're going to pay off the police and all that. And we'll, you know, once a month, they'll come in and raid the place and they'll give us advance warning. Because if it gets too ugly, if people start to get killed, then they're going to have to come down on us and the whole thing will shut down. And that's what happens eventually in the early 60s. But until then, it was a milder version of what went on in big cities. Your other question was about, procedure as a historian. As a writer of history, I also do journalism. Both professions are similar in many respects. In both cases, if you have you learn a piece of information, if it's not terribly important, you know, what color somebody's car, what kind of car they drove, whatever, then you just take it as fact. But if it's a little bit controversial or a little bit, challenging, then what you do is you get a second independent source. If you can find a second independent source, then that's solid. That's kind of how you work in history and in journalism. So that's that. And then if I can't, but I want to say it, but some guy's telling me this, then I'm at liberty to say, okay, this guy, and I'll quote him saying that. So then the reader knows, okay, that's that guy's recollection. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's true, I wasn't able to determine.
Russell Shorto is our guest. The name of the new book, Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. How did Johnstown, Pennsylvania, how has that city held up over the years compared to the time that you're writing about?
Johnstown's a classic Rust Belt town. Its population at its height was 66,000. Today it's about 19,000. It rose on the steel mills and it fell with the steel mills. And it's now kind of a shell of what it once was. But I always say, and I really think it's true, it's a great place to be from. They're great people, you know, just like they're people. And it's now, you know, Johnstown is one of those communities that took to Trump wholeheartedly because people are looking for, you know, because nobody's paying attention to them. There's no solution out there on the table for them. As America tries to re-envision itself, it's one of those places that we have to take account of.
You also went to Italy, and I'm interested in why that was important and what you learned from that experience.
I've learned about myself as a writer. I mean, if you look at my books, I wrote about the Dutch founding of New York, about the American Revolution. I wrote a book about the historical Jesus and then a book about my family, my hometown. What on earth do they have in common? Well, it's in one way or another, each of those is me trying to get to the origins of something. So when I lived in New York, the origins were Dutch. Obviously, the American Revolution, you know, you're trying to understand it anew. And so in this case, since I was exploring my family and my grandfather in particular, those roots were in this little village in Sicily called San Pier Niceto. And going there, you know, getting a sense of place is always invaluable when you're writing about something. And going to this village, it sits high in the mountains, looking down on the port of Messina, wandering the streets and the town's unofficial historian took me. I brought my family and took us all through the town, and we met several people. We were, you know, in the evening in Italy, you have passeggiata, where everybody goes out and walks around the town. And during the passeggiata, we encountered probably five or six people with the name last name Sciotto, so that we were talking with them, and you know, probably we're related somehow. You know, so that gives you then a real sense of grounding for this story that you're going to build on top of it.
I'm also curious, you write about your grandfather, but your great-grandmother and your grandmother, the women of this story, who are very involved and yet sort of, not really even sort of, but turn a blind eye to what is actually happening.
Yeah, you're struggling to find words there. Makes total sense, because it's hard to try to figure out what, you know, what were the women doing? What were they thinking? I think part of it is simply back then, you know, whatever the husband's job was, he didn't bring it home with him. He didn't, like now we're all involved in our spouses, what they do at work and all that. Then the men came home and the wife had dinner on the table, and, you know, the wife didn't know what he did and didn't, that wasn't her affair. So that carried over to a large extent. And Joe, my grandfather's partner, his wife, Millie, would say when people would bring up the mafia, she'd say, oh, there's no such thing. And I think she probably believed it. You know, I mean, I think she, you know, Freud has an expression, knowing and not knowing. So you kind of fool yourself so that you can, you know, live a nice life. So I think there was some of that. On the other hand, my grandmother, you know, my grandfather, in addition to running this operation, he was a notorious and very skilled cheat and gambler. And he would run big card games. And, you know, my dad would remember him, you know, practicing on the dining room table before he went off to a card game for hours at a time. He'd practice, you know, dealing from the bottom of the deck or dealing the second card. So he'd win a lot of money, and he'd win from people, you know, sometimes they were from out of town, but sometimes they were from the guy who runs the women's clothing store or whatever in town. And he would take his winnings in proceeds. So he'd say to his wife, go down to the, you know, ladies' clothing store and take whatever you want. So she'd go down there, and the manager would walk behind her and, you know, pile dresses on his arm as she walked around, you know. So she had to know that this wasn't normal. But apparently they didn't talk too overtly about these things.
Your grandfather is very well thought of in Johnstown. He was a community leader, really. People looked to him, but they also knew that he was in the mob, which I guess gets back to what you were saying earlier about that. They knew the system was rigged, and here was a guy who figured out how to level the playing field for the little guy.
Yeah, I think what you just said is, to some extent, that stayed part of people's mindset, because the people who were, for the most part, the people who were involved in playing the numbers and would come to their pool halls and things, they were working class people. And so many of these old guys said, oh, we would see Russ or Joe walking by with their suits on and, you know, we'd say, hey, Russ, how you doing? And, you know, how they admired them. They were kids who looked up to them. And they felt that to some extent they were on their side. And several people told me stories about how, you know, Russ would come into the lunchroom and then he'd have lunch and he'd leave. And then later you'd find out he had bought lunch for the whole place, you know, that kind of thing, which, you know, it's kind of, I guess, like being a politician. This is a way of, you know, making people feel good and feel that they're on your side. So there was that element to it.
Again, Russell Sciurro's new book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. It is published by Norton. You can listen again to this and find past book shows via podcast at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.